story in this week's Parsha, Parsha's Pinchas. It says that the daughters of Tzlafchad, Ben Chefer, Ben Gilad, Ben Macher, Ben Menasha, this was the family of the tribe of Menasha. The man Tzlafchad was dead. His daughters petitioned Moshe, you have the right to petition your leaders, the daughters petitioned Moshe Rabbeinu as follows. They said there were five girls, it says five women, it says they were Machla, Noah, Chagla, Milka, Vatirza. It says they stood before Moshe, before Elazar, the Kohen, before the Nesiim, before Kol Ha'edah, the whole assemblage. They stood Pesach al Moed, and they petitioned as follows. Avinu Meis Bamidbar, our father Tzlafcha died in the desert. He was not B'toch Ha'edah Hanoadim al Hashem, Badas Korach. He was not involved in the rebels, in the rebellion. He was not involved in the rebellion of Korach. B'cheto Meis, he died for some personal reason. Banim lo hayu lo. Lama Yigar Hashem Avinu Mitoch Mishpachto. Why should our father, why should he be left behind? Why should his family not inherit? Why should we not inherit? Kein lo ben, there are no sons. They assumed apparently that the inheritance normally goes to sons. When there are no sons, I'm not sure what they thought would happen, but they were worried that the estate would pass out of the family. They said, Tna lanu achuza b'tochachei avinu. Give us his estate. Well, along with the other brothers of our father, they should, each brother should have his, should the, his property, should remain in his family, so let my, our father's estate remain in our family, give it to us. This was their petition to Moshe Rabbeinu. We would like to inherit our father's estate in the absence of any male heirs. It says, Vayakrev Moshe es mishpatan lefnei Hashem. Moshe took their question, he didn't pass it himself, he took the question to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So the commentators say some interesting things, actually, on the pasuk that says, they emphasized to Moshe, they said, our father was not part of Korach's rebellion, our father had nothing to do with that, therefore we petition you as follows. Well, what was the connection? What do they mean to say, our father was not involved in Korach? What happened, had he been involved in Korach? What would have happened then? So, commentators say different things, what the significance of that was. Some suggest that they were afraid that Moshe would be angry at them. Korach was a personal affront. Korach was a rejection of Moshe's authority. So they were afraid that Moshe would be prejudiced against their case. They emphasized, no, our father was not one of your enemies. Our father was not one of your political opponents. It's striking that they would think Moshe Rabbeinu could be so biased, but that's how some commentators learned. They were emphasizing that he was not involved in the rebellion against you. Other commentators make a kind of opposite point, corresponding point. They say that it says Moshe kicked the case upstairs. Moshe said, I'm not doing this myself. I'm going to ask HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Some say it was because it was a question of Shochad Dvarim. Halach of Shochad is you're not allowed to bribe a judge, and the rules are fairly strict, at least L'chatchila, at least as a Midas Chasidus, any kindness, any graciousness, any minor thing from the litigant to the judge is a reason for him to recuse himself, at least L'chatchila. Moshe was saying, because you're emphasizing that your father wasn't opposed to me, because you're saying nice things to me, I can't pass into your case myself. I have to bring the case to Kosh Baruch. Other commentators say the reason they went in front of the whole Eidah, it says they went not just to Moshe, they went in front of Moshe and Aaron and Elazar and, not Aaron, Aaron had already passed away. They went to Moshe, Elazar, the Nesiim, the Kol Eidah, because to avoid Chashad, because Moshe could have been potentially biased, they went in front of a larger assemblage to make sure that any possibility of bias was eliminated. So some say that the people involved in Korach might have forfeited their property. It's like in certain cases, if you commit a crime against the Melech, your estate is forfeit. So there are all kinds of different shatim in the commentators, what exactly the significance of Lo Hayu B'tocha Eidah was. But in any event, this was their petition to Moshe and the other leaders of the Jewish people. We would like to inherit the land. And Hashem, the answer that Hashem returned to Moshe was, yes, they are correct. Vayomer Hashem Moshe Lemer, Kain benos tzlavcha dovros, they speak correctly, they're right, they speak truly. Noson titin lehem achuzas nachla b'tocha chayavim, they deserve to inherit the estate parallel to their cousins, their uncle's children, their heirs as anybody else's. Vavartim vavartos nachla savien lehem, and you shall indeed transfer their father's estate, their father's property to them. This is, this and the subsequent psukim, this is the discussion in the Torah of the laws of inheritance. It's, you know, it's interesting that they kind of assumed that they knew what the halacha was. If there were sons, the sons would inherit. The Torah didn't even bother to tell you that. But nevertheless, the next few psukim, this is the classic discussion in Torah Shebichtav of Yerusha. All the halachas of Yerusha, of what happens when a man dies, are derived from the next, you know, four or five psukim or so, as well as the Torah Shebaal Peh, the Gemara that we have on this. So we'll discuss today the laws of Yerusha, inheritance, as well as a number of related topics, including writing wills, and so on. So there are actually two parashas in the Torah about Yerusha. This is the main one, here in Parashas Penchas. There is one other parasha that is in Parashas Kisete. The Torah says, if a man has two wives and they both bear him children, and the ben habachar is lasnia, the eldest, the firstborn, not the eldest, the firstborn specifically is to the snia, the wife who he likes less or he dislikes. So it says, v'haya v'yaman chilo es banav, when he disposes of his property, of his estate, eser sheyelo, lo yuchal avakir es ben ahuv al pnei ben asnu habachar. He's not allowed to prefer, to privilege the ben ahuva, the son of the favored wife, against the bachar. Ki es habachar ben asnu ayakir. He has to recognize, acknowledge the claims of the Bechar, his firstborn, even if it's Ben Asnua. Lo Pishnayim, to give him a double portion. B'chol Asher Yimatzei Lo, everything he has gets Pishnayim. Ki Hu Reishis Ono Lo Mishpat HaBechar. Since he is the firstborn of his loins, of the firstborn of the man, he gets a double chelek. This is the famous halacha of Bechar, that a firstborn son gets what we call Pishnayim, twice as much as any other son. So for example, forget the case of two wives, not really relevant today, but if a man has four sons, so instead of dividing the estate into four equal portions, which is what you do if there is no bechar, instead of simply dividing the estate into four portions, if one of them is a bechar, if one of them is the firstborn son of the man, you divide the estate into five portions, you give the bechar two, you give the other ones, we call the other ones the pshutim, the non-bechar, the simple ones, we give the other ones one each, and resulting that the bechar is getting twice as much as any of the pshutim. So these are the two halachas of Yerusha in the Torah.
Is there another one? The people of the tribe came to Moshe and said, why do they have to marry?
Yes. Mr. Bramson is pointing out there is one further discussion of Yerusha. The story of the Benos Tzalafchad does not end here. We have in Parashas Matos, I think, a little bit later, it says that there was a counter petition. After Moshe, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, after they ruled that the daughters of Tzalafchad were going to inherit their father's property, it says that their cousins, the cousins were worried. It says in the end of Parashas Masseh, the very end of Chumash Dvarim, it's about Chumash Mamidbar, it says that you're going to give the daughters of Tzalafchad property. So it says that if they get married to members of other Shvatim, then the property will pass out of Ar Shevet, the husband will inherit, the children will inherit. We'll discuss a little bit of that later, exactly how the inheritance works. But basically there was a concern that since they were women, the property would, since the Yichus of the Shevet, of course, goes by the parental lineage. If they were women, their property would eventually, after they died, would pass out of the Shevet and would pass into another Shevet. So the members of this Shevet had a pride of the Shevet or interested in the preservation of the influence, the affluence, the pride of the Shevet. So they said that this is a problem, that the property is going to pass away from our Shevet. So again, Moshe said, Al Pi Hashem, that Cain Mati Bnei Yosef Dovrim, the same language. Here we have Cain Bnos Tzalafchad Dovros, and there it says Cain Mati Bnei Yosef Dovrim. It's actually interesting. I don't have anything to say about this, but the language, the verb form Dover is a very unusual one in the Torah. Usually we say midaber is much more common. Lidaber, midaber, vayidaber, dover is it's not unheard of, but it's a relatively less common form. Here you have it kind of a parallel pasuk twice, once by the Benos Tzalafchad, once again by the counter petition of the rest of the Shevet, the rest of Shevet Yosef, the rest of Shevet Menashe. So Hashem said, you're right. The way we'll compromise here is that they will get the property, but they should marry only Mishpachas Mati Avihem. They have to marry only members of their tribe. So even when they die and the property passes away from them, it'll remain within the tribe And indeed, that's what it says. The Torah says, Lo sisav nachla leveis Yisrael imatel nata. There's a commandment from HaKadosh Baruch Hu that we don't want the nachla to be distributed to a different shevet. Ish b'nachlas matev osiv yidbeku. B'chol bas yireshes nachla, not limited to b'nos tzlafchon. Any daughter who is going to be inheriting property has the same commandment. Le'echad in mishpachas matev yatiyah. She should marry within her shevet. And the Torah goes on. Like Kasher Tiva Hashem Kenasi Benos Slavchad, they followed the commandments. Batiyena Machla Tirtza V'Chagla Milka V'Noa. These five women Benos Slavchad L'Nei Dodei L'Nashim. They married their cousins, and the property therefore stayed within the Shevet. Now, Chazal tell us, the Gemara tells us, this was not actually, unlike the halachas we're going to be focusing on from our parasha, the general laws of Yerusha. These halachas were not ordinary mitzvahs like the rest of Taryag that apply forever, that apply for all generations. This was a special harasha, a special limited commandment that was enforced in the time of the Midbar, that first generation of Jews. This was a commandment to them. This does not apply to in our day and age. If a girl today certainly can inherit property, even without a will, if she has no brothers, halacha l'maisa, as we'll discuss, she will inherit the property. She is not bound by this mitzvah of marrying within her shevet. For example, we don't really have Shvatim today. We don't know who shevet, but we do have Kohanim, Levim, and Yisraelim. If a non-Kohen woman inherits from her father, and she wants to marry a Kohen or something, or vice versa, there is no commandment that she be limited to marrying within her shevet. This halacha is not in force beyond that specific time. But there was such a rule in the time of the Midbar, but it did not apply in future generations. Right. Okay. So that's basically the halacha. These are the three discussions of Yerusha in the Torah. The main one being the one in our parsha, which discusses what we call the Seder Nachlos, the order in which the heirs are Yarish. So let's run through the basic system of the Torah for who's Yarish. Hashem tells Moshe, Hashem as follows. The rule is El Bnei Yisrael Tadaber Lamar. Ishki Yamos Ubein Einlo. The Torah kind of takes for granted, like the Bnos Tzlafchad also did, the first in line are sons. If there are no sons, then daughters inherit. If a man has no daughter, no son or daughter, then his brother inherits him. This is actually a little bit misleading. Chazal explained that the brother is not actually the next in line. If a man dies with no son and no daughter, the next in line is actually his father. The father is the next closest relative. If there's no father either, the Torah leaves out that little bit. If there's no father, then the next in line is the brother. The brother's actually the fourth in line. If the man who died has no brothers, then it goes up to his father's brothers again. It's a little misleading, but the first one in line would actually be his father's father. If the father's father is not here, then it goes down to the father's father's son, meaning the father's brother, meaning the uncle. And if there are no brothers, then you give it to the closest relatives, the mishpachto, and so on and so forth. Put into modern terminology, the rule basically is as follows. Putting aside spouses, we'll discuss spouses soon. In the case where there are no spouses involved, the rule is as follows. There are basically three yarshim. In order of precedence, there are son, daughter, father. They get in that order. If there is one or more sons, then they get everything. Nobody else gets anything. If there are no sons, but there are daughters, the daughters get everything, nobody else gets anything. If there are no sons or daughters, then the father is the third Yarish, it goes up to the father. And then we apply a general rule that says, to all three of these Yarishim, anytime someone is in line to be Yarish, if he is dead but he has descendants, they all get before the next one. So for example, if a man has a son and a daughter, the son dies and the son left over a family, sons or daughters, they all get before the daughter gets because they stand in place of the son. So since a son precedes a daughter, all the son's children precede the daughter also. And so if there are no sons, means there are no sons and no descendants to those sons, then it goes to the daughter. If the daughter isn't around, it goes to any of her descendants. If there are no sons or daughters or any surviving descendants, then it goes to the father. The father, if he's alive, he gets it. If the father's not around, any of his descendants get it, meaning the first one after the father is the father's son, meaning the brother of the deceased, or the next one would be the grandson, meaning the nephew of the deceased. So any of the father's descendants would get it. The rule is ha'av kodim l'chol yotzei chalatzav. Any one of these yarshim precedes all his descendants, but if he's not around, his descendants are next. If he and all his descendants are not around, you go one generation up to the next father, grandfather, all the grandfather's descendants, no grandfather, no descendants, great-grandfather, all his descendants. So as you go up to great-grandfather, you're dealing with second cousins, third cousins, great-great-grandfather, and then on down to third cousins, and so on and so forth. So basically, any normal member of Klal Yisrael is going to have some relative sooner or later. As long as Klal Yisrael still exists as an entity, the Gemara actually says, Gemira de lo kala shifta, we have a tradition that no shevet will ever be eliminated, so that every shevet will always have some members. So you go all the way back to Reuven, and then down, you'll find some cousin somewhere. You have to trace it back as far as you can. But that is how the Yerusha works. It goes always son, daughter, father, father's kids, son's kids, in between, your first son or son's kids, daughter, daughter's kids, father, father's kids. Then you go up again, grandfather, grandfather's kids, great-grandfather, great-grandfather's kids, and so on and so forth, all the way down. There's no such thing as partial Yerusha. Basically, the Yareshue, who is of the highest, the closest level of Kurva, gets everything. Him and his brothers and siblings parallel get everything, and anyone lower gets nothing. So there's no such thing as cousins getting something, brothers getting something, sons getting something. If there are sons, no one else gets anything. If there are brothers, no one else gets anything, and so on and so forth. You find the closest heirs who are still alive, they get everything, all of them who are equal. And the other rule we said was that the descendants of somebody stand in for him. So if a person has two sons and neither of them are around, and one had three sons and one had six sons and a daughter, you first divide the estate into two halves. Each son gets half, and then the two sons are not around, so each half passes down to his kids. So the three sons over there, three grandsons, split half the estate three ways. The other half of the estate goes to the family with six kids, and they split it among themselves, and that's how the Yerusha works. Those halakhas are all relatively uncontested. They're pretty much universally accepted. The one complication, the one break from the simple and straightforward rule is spouses. Unlike modern law, we say sons get everything, daughters get nothing. Similarly with spouses, the halakha is husbands stand first in line, even ahead of sons. Husbands get everything from their wives. If the wives predecease them, they inherit everything. Wives get nothing. Wives do not inherit anything from their husbands. The wives do have ksuva. The wives do have certain contractual rights. They get ksuva. They get certain maintenance in certain cases. They get room and board and food and other things. There's child support for kids, for daughters, and certain daughters also. Daughters don't inherit, but they do have the right to certain levels of support. But the basic estate never passes from a husband to a wife, ever, beyond the ksuva. It does pass to a daughter, but only if there are no sons. And also, an estate never passes to a mother. A mother is never yarish, never yareshes. So you always have to look for the closest relative on the paternal side, but a mother is never yareshes. There's actually a very interesting discussion in the commentators to Megillas Rus. In the end of Megillas Rus, there's a very opaque story over there, very hard to understand what's going on. It says that there was the legal part of the story. It says that Naomi and Rus, they had some property. The property used to belong to their husbands and children, Nachla and Kilion and Elimelech. And Boaz said, he asked somebody to redeem it. He asked the Goel, do you want to redeem this property? He said, yeah, sure, I'll redeem it. And then he said, but you have to marry Rus. And he said, no, I don't want to do that. Penash says Nachlasi. So he backed out. So the question was, forget the Yibum question, forget the question of the marriage and the Yibum, which is the central part of the story. Let's focus on the Nachla, let's focus on the property. Whose properties were these? It says that they had belonged to Elimelech, they belonged to the family of the men, and yet apparently Naomi and Rus had some veto power here, so they were making conditions and rules. You had to negotiate with them. So what was their relationship to the property of Elimelech's family? So most of the commentators say their rights would have come about via ksuva. That they had ksuva, whether it was the modern ksuva, whether it was some proto-ksuva, some early form of marriage settlement, even though the property was of the family of Elimelech. But nevertheless, because they had been married, Naomi and Rus had been married to Elimelech and his son, therefore they had rights of ksuva and they had a lien, so anyone who wanted the property would have to first settle, pay off their lien and meet their conditions, and that was the right that they had. The Ben Ezra, And one of the Ben Ezra, as we've discussed previously, often says some startlingly ahalachic things, some startlingly divergent from Chazal statements. This is one of them. I've never seen anyone pick up on this, but this is one of his most most striking deviations from Chazal. The Ben Ezra says that either it was ksuva or a mother is yarish. A mother is yarish is against the most fundamental rules of Yerusha. A mother is not yarish. It's a Mishnah. Not only is it a Mishnah, it says it twice in the Mishnah. It says Yesh Nochlin, and the name of a whole parak in Baba Basra is Yesh Nochlin, Parak Yesh Nochlin, the chapter that deals with Yerusha. It says Yesh Nochlin v'lo manchilin. Someone can inherit and not be manchil, not pass to somebody else, and that is a question of a mother and a son. The son is yarish the mother. The son is not morish to his mother, and vice versa. The Mishnah says Yesh manchilin v'lo nochlin. A mother is manchil. She passes the Yerusha to her son. She's not nochel. She's not nochel from her son. There's no debate about this. There's no argument. This is something which is a fundamental, kind of a cardinal rule of Yerusha. A mother is not yarish. Why the Ben Ezra says such a strange thing, I don't know. But in any event, these are the basic rules. A husband inherits his wife, gets everything. Children get nothing. We should clarify that unlike in some versions of Western law, where property held during a marriage is typically marital property, it belongs to both spouses, it has to be divided after the marriage breaks up or someone dies. Halacha doesn't really have that notion. Halacha gives a woman full rights. The woman has her own assets, assets she brought into the marriage, assets she inherits during the marriage. A woman does have her independent property. So any property during a marriage, we don't have a notion of marital property. We have his property and we have her property. It is true that he has certain rights over her property. Generally speaking, her property becomes nichse malug. He has certain liens over it. He can block her from selling it because he's going to be yarish it. That's one reason. He can use it. He can get the proceeds from it if he rents it out, or if he uses it, he gets the usufruct, the payros of it, we say. But the property and title remains hers. The title is still in her name. And if the marriage breaks up, whether by death or divorce, she takes her property back. Now, if she dies, then instead of her sons being yarish, it's a special halacha, the husband is yarish. But if he dies first, she takes back all her property. Not Yerusha, simply the pshat is, it's her property, and she walks away with it when the marriage is over. Or if he divorces her, she takes all the property back. So, but in terms of Yerusha, if she predeceases him, he is yarish and takes all her property. If he predeceases her, then she's not yarish him, so she doesn't get his property, but she does get all her property, she takes it back. Now, these are the basic halachas of Yerusha, the Torah, and obviously they diverge from modern law in two or three major ways. One of them is that the Torah does not, even though the Torah says, the girl is yarish when there's no son, the girl is not yarish when there is a son. That is not like modern law, obviously, modern Western law. Second halacha is spouses. Modern law treats the spouses roughly equally. Doesn't give them all the Yerusha, but it gives them something. Spoke about this last week jointly in a panel with a lawyer who gave us the laws of Maryland, D.C., and Virginia. So in Maryland, for example, the spouse's share is one half if there is a surviving minor child. Children get the other half. Or 15,000 plus one half if there are survivors other than a minor child, 15,000 plus half if there is no surviving child but a parent, 100% if there are no parents and no children. Halacha, as we've said, never really splits the Yerusha. Halacha always has only one tier of Yerush. If it's a husband, he gets everything. Otherwise, the children get everything. Halacha never splits the Yerusha like this. And also, Halacha distinguishes between husband and wife. Wife inherits nothing, husband inherits everything. And husband inherits everything, even if there are children. Children get nothing of the wife's estate. Husband gets everything. One other area where the law apparently diverges from halacha: what happens if there are no heirs at all? Now, we mentioned earlier, in a normal situation, you can always find heirs because no children, parents, no parents, grandparents, and you go high enough up, you can go back 10 generations to 20 generations, 30 generations, all the way to Reuven or Yaakov Avinu, and then go down to whoever is left alive. So as long as some Jew is alive, there ought to be somebody who's Yarish somewhere. Nevertheless, there are cases in Halacha where there are no Yarshim alive at all. One example is a Ger. If someone converts to Judaism legally, biologically, he has family, obviously, but legally he has no family. Another common case is even if someone who technically does have family, but if the family are completely out of the picture, the Gemara talks about a shtuki or an asufi, if someone's parentage is completely unknown, even if his mother is known, as we said, mother is not Yarish, mother is not relevant for Yerusha purposes, so someone who has a child out of wedlock and we have no idea who the father is, such a person has no father for halakhic purposes, and the state, so here we find a big difference between state law, my wife tells me this is true in states in general, well, pretty much everywhere. Under state law, it goes to the government. If no one is alive under the above, the state will escheat, E-S-C-H-E-A-T. Apparently that means the state takes all the money, D.C., the district gets all the money, Virginia, the Commonwealth gets all the money. In halacha, that is not what happens. The state, there's no state getting the money. In halacha, if there are no heirs at all, like in the case of Ger or Shtuki, the property becomes Hefker. The famous Nichsei Ager becomes Hefker, and anyone who wants can take it. The Piskei Tshuva, the Achronim, bring a very interesting distinction in halacha. They talk about a case, the case of the Shtuki is someone where the father was never in the picture, we never really have any idea. The mother may have known at the time who the father was, but there's no evidence, there's no trail, there's no chance of ever finding out who he was. That's the classic case of Shtuki. There are Achronim who claim, in a case where the father was in the picture, they were married, for example, there was a father, but eventually he divorced her and moved out, and then the trail is cold, and before they have modern communication, social security numbers, you couldn't find him. In that case, the Rapposkim who say the property is not Hefker, because there is a father. You just don't know where he is right now. So there we treat it like an Aveda, like a Shas Aveda. If you find property and you can't find the owner, so if there's Yeyush, if he gave up hope, you can keep it. But if there's no Yeyush, etc., the property becomes an Aveda. We say Yehimunach Ad Sheyavo Eliyo, you have to keep it somewhere, keep it secure for the eventual day where you'll find the lucky owner. So here too, the Rapposkim who say, if the father was in the picture and potentially we could find him again, if we can track him down, even if he's not here today and we have no short-term hope of finding him, the property remains, the remains that belongs to him, and you have to hold it for him securely. But in a case where there's no father at all, there never will be a father, biologically there was one, but he's lost beyond trace, then the property becomes Hefker, not the government, like in modern American law, but it becomes Hefker. These are the laws of Yerusha according to the Torah. Now, unlike many areas in Choshen Mishpat, where contract law, employment, the landlords and tenants, these types of cases, partnership law, where the Torah doesn't really care how you want to arrange your affairs. The Torah has extensive defaults. What happens if there's no partnership agreement? What happens in a default lease where various contingencies weren't spelled out? Halakha has extensive rules for what the default is. But you have pretty much total freedom of contract. You can do whatever you want. You can rearrange your things however you want. The Torah gives you the basic framework if you don't specify otherwise. The Torah is perfectly happy with a person who decides to arrange things differently. So what happens about Yerusha? Yerusha is very different. Yerusha, there's an entire body of halacha which says that the Torah does not want you to disinherit people. The Torah does not want you to give out, to take your estate and dispose of it differently from the Torah. The Torah wants you to follow the rules of the Torah. The Gemara talks about this in two or three places. One Gemara says that there's a mitzvah to help someone's daughters marry. There's a mitzvah to give them dowries. There's a mitzvah to give your daughter a dowry to enable her to get married. So the Gemara says, because of that, that's why the Gemara dashes from Sukkim. It says in Yirmiyah, it says, "Kachu nashim, v'holidu banim uvanos, kul uvnechem nashim." Find wives for your daughters, and find wives for your sons, and find husbands for your daughters. How do you find a husband? The Gemara says, offer her a large dowry. So the Gemara says, you see from here, there's a mitzvah to help a girl get married by giving her a dowry. Otherwise, the Gemara says, it would be usher to do that. That would be called havaras nachla. That would be called disposing of your estate differently from the Torah. The Torah said the son should get your property, not your daughters. If not for the fact that there's a mitzvah to help your daughter get married, it would be usher, it would be a violation of havaras nachla. Now, some poskim extend this beyond dowry. Some poskim say, for example, that the same mitzvah that there is to help the daughter get married in the first place, there is a mitzvah of shalom bayis to help to avoid machlokas in the family so that the husband will be fond of his wife. So even after your daughter's married, there's a mitzvah to put her in your will, or to a heter, and even a mitzvah to put her in your will. so that the husband shouldn't be angry at her. He shouldn't resent her for not bringing him a share of her father's property. Additionally, Rav Zalman Lechemia Goldberg says that not only is there a question of shalom bayis, it's even part of the mitzvah of dowry, because even if the husband who marries the daughter is polite enough, he doesn't ask for a promise of a dowry in writing, he has an expectation that sooner or later she will bring him part of her father's estate. And therefore, the eventual giving her in a normal will that we do today, giving her some property, is what he relies on mitchila. The whole system is built like that he marries her knowing that he'll get some of the property eventually. So that also becomes part of the mitzvah of helping her get married. But so even though the Torah says daughters are not yorish anything, this is one major exception. Even though the Gemara says mitzad echad, it's really wrong to try to subvert the Torah's Yerusha and give the daughters. Mitzad sheni, there is a mitzvah of dowry, of shalom bayis, of helping his daughter get married and helping her retain her husband's affection. There is a mitzvah to give her something. But putting this aside, putting this dowry question aside, putting the shalom bayis question aside, the Gemara makes it pretty clear that there is, in general, an avera against redistributing Yerusha. Unlike, as we said, when it comes to landlords and tenants and stuff like that, in general, the Torah doesn't care. Arrange your affairs however you want. When it comes to Yerusha, the Torah does care. You're not supposed to disinherit children. You're not supposed to rearrange your estate in a way different from the Torah's rules. So this becomes, obviously, a major question. We write wills today. How are we allowed to do this? How are we allowed to write wills if the Torah says that the Gemara says there's an isser of havaras nachla, there's an isser of redistributing your estate other than according to the Torah's plan? So this question goes back at least 600 or 700 years, where the wills began, but an early form of estate settlement we find in Ashkenazi communities began already as far back as the 15th or 14th century. This was called the Shtar Chatzi Zachar. This was not the way we do it today, a classic will that a person writes, a last will and testament to dispose of all his property in deposits with the court. This was done actually in the form of dowry settlements. When a rich man would marry his daughter to some son-in-law, he would give the son-in-law typically a document at the marriage that said that you or she will be entitled to a portion of my estate. It was called chatzi zachar because typically they wouldn't give the daughter and the son-in-law an equal amount to the sons. They would give chatzi zachar, they would give half the amount the sons got. Now, the chatzi zachar was normal. There were certain cases, Rav Zalman Lechemia brings, there were certain cases where they did kulo zachar, zachar shalem. They gave the daughter and son-in-law a share equal to the sons, much less common, but he says you can do that too, that's also fine. So the question arises, how does this fit with the prohibition against havaras nachla? The whole purpose, these weren't wills in the modern sense, but these were documents whose entire purpose was to divert a portion of the rich man's estate to the daughters, to the son-in-laws. How are you allowed to do that? How are you allowed to do that in defiance of the prohibition against havaras nachla? So one answer that we've been leading up to is that dowries are an exception. Dowries, in order to help the daughter get married, a dowry is an exception. Even though they were giving much more than the Gemara, says maybe 10% of the estate you can give, they were giving more. They were giving chatzi zachar, which could be a much larger share. But that there's no limit. Whatever you have to give to the daughter to help her get married, whatever's necessary as a reasonable form of dowry, there's a heter. So that wouldn't be a heter for writing a will in general to give your cousin or to give somebody else, but at least for daughters, and they're probably the most common case. When someone writes a will today, the most common situation is he wants to give his daughter some money and not give it all to the sons. So there is a heter based on this Gemara, based on this old tradition of writing a Shtar Chatzi Zachar to give a share of the estate to the girls. There are a number of other heterim. Most of we mentioned earlier, the laws of Yerusha are pretty set in stone. There's very few machloks, and there's a pretty standard way of doing things. But this prohibition of Havaras Nachla, the Isser of Avurei Efsanta, of diverting Yerusha, is shrouded in machlokas. Virtually every detail, every aspect of it is machlokas. One of the most fundamental machlokas is, does it apply only if you disinherit somebody totally? If you take away, you say, you son, I don't like you, you did something, you crossed me somewhere, I'm taking away, you're not getting anything? Or even if you give them something, but you divert part of the estate to somebody else. Some poskim learn that as long as part of the estate is still given according to the laws of Yerusha, even if another part of the estate is divided according to your will, that's fine. As long as the laws of Yerusha, the Torah, still hold with regard to a portion of the estate. Some say even a pretty small portion, some say it has to be a significant portion, some say most of your estate. But whatever it is, as long as there's, according to many poskim, as long as a significant part of your estate whatever the significant means. But as long as a significant part of your estate is being divided according to Din Torah, the rest can be apportioned according to your desires. And that was actually why in the Shtar Chatzi Zachar, in the traditional Shtar Chatzi Zachar, certain asset classes were accepted. Real estate, Sfarim, Sifrei Kodesh were accepted. The reasons why, again, were not clear. But some poskim said that was the reason. In order to avoid the prohibition of Avuri Achsanta, we say that certain asset classes are excluded from the will and shall be subject to Din Torah, the classic laws of Ben and Not Bas and all that. And the rest of the assets, cash and other property, will be distributed according to securities, whatever will be distributed according to the will. But as long as you're dividing some of your estate according to Din Torah, that's fine. And some poskim today will still say that when you make a will, you should exempt either some asset classes from the terms of the will, or at least a certain sum of money. You say, let's say some poskim from Moshe said $1,000. Say $1,000 in my estate shall be divided according to Din Torah, Bechor and girls, not girls and boys and everything, and the rest of the estate shall be divided according to my will. $1,000 several decades ago might have to be revised for today's economics, but a davar chashuv, a significant amount of your will, if you divide that, that is fine. Some poskim say that if bequests are made, if gifts are made while you're alive, that's not subject to the rule of Avuri Achsanta. Even if it's a form of estate planning, that's your goal, but if you make a gift while you're alive, that is not subject to this prohibition against diverting your assets. The Gemara seems to indicate not like that. The Gemara was talking about a man who gave his daughter a dowry while she was still alive, and even that would be subject to Avuri Achsanta if not for the special hetzer of dowry. So many poskim say, no, even gifts that are made while you're alive are still subject to the prohibition against reorganizing your estate. Again, even that's a machlokas. Contemporary poskim discuss things like trust, living trust, where you put the assets aside while you're still alive. Complicated question, kind of a cutting-edge halakhic question, how these rules apply to trusts. Not going to get into that. Revocable trust, non-revocable trust, but so virtually everything to do with Avuri Achsanta is a machlokas. But Lamaisa, the custom today is that people do write wills and people do give their daughters certainly substantial amounts. The custom is even common, as Rav Zalman Nechemiah says, you can give the daughter even Zachar Shalem, that was not the common practice traditionally, but he says you can do that as long as you can solve the problem of Avuri Achsanta by some of the various Torah we've been discussing. Some say to avoid machlokas, to avoid Shalom Bayis problems, usually it's a good idea. Rav Zalman Nechemiah himself was dealing with a similar problem. He says in Israel, the government passed the law. They want it to be modern. They want it to be Western. So the government passed the law that, unlike the Torah law, which says that the girls are not Yarish, the girls have to be Yarish. And the courts demanded that the Batei Din follow the modern Israeli law and not paskin halacha on this matter. They were embarrassed. They resented the halacha of the Torah, that girls don't get anything. So the Batei Din had their hands tied. They were not able to pass in Yerusha according to Din Torah. They would have to pass in according to the law. The problem is, the poskim all say, that's gzela. If a daughter takes money, which the law gives her, and she's not entitled to LP Din Torah, that's gezel. She goes to court, she's violating the prohibition of harkos, of going to secular court. If she takes money, shalok din, it's gzela. Very serious isser. There's a famous tshuva of the Rashba. The Rashba was asked about a certain community where the custom was, the question wasn't daughter, here the question was a woman who died, the question was, should her father be Yarish or should her husband be Yarish? As we discussed earlier, in Torah law, the husband is in first position. If there is a husband alive when she dies, he gets everything. In the French Christian law, whatever the medieval law was, the father would be Yarish. And there was a certain Jewish community that was accustomed to following the French law. That the French or Spanish, whatever it was, the secular law at the time, Christian law, secular law, that the father would be Yarish in first position before the husband. So a woman died. The husband said, I want to follow Torah law. I'm Yarish. The father said, our custom is to follow non-Jewish law. I want to follow that. So what do you do? So we know there is a principle called Dina Melchusedina. There are cases where the Torah itself says that you follow secular law. The Rashba has a vehement diatribe rejecting the application of that rule to Yerusha. He says, Chas v'shalom, lo tehei kezos b'Yisrael, ha-Torah chagera sak u'mukonenes. If we do such a thing, the Torah would be in mourning. It's a slap in the face of the Torah. It's a rejection of the law of the Torah. And Chas v'shalom, Yerusha has to follow Torah law. If anyone takes possession of assets in accordance with secular law where the Torah doesn't agree, such a person is a gazlan and is rejecting the Torah, a terrible thing. And that is pretty much the consensus of virtually all poskim throughout the generations, that when it comes to Yerusha, you must follow Torah law.
What if the woman passes her own property before she gets married? It's her own, not that she brings it from her father and takes it.
So even her own property would be inherited by her husband. If she predeceases him, any property she has, regardless of where it came from, he would be Yerush. If he dies before her, then she retrieves all property, whether it's from her father or her own property. But even her own property is inherited by her husband. The husband is simply the first Yerush. In the scheme of Yerushim, he's simply in first place. So wherever she got the property from, he's Yerushim.
During the marriage?
During the marriage, it has a special status called Nichse Malug. She has the title. It's her property. However, he has use of it. He has the right to farm it or rent it out, and the rental proceeds on a year-by-year basis go to him. He gets them. But the title remains hers. So it's kind of joint in the sense that he can block her from selling it, she can block him from selling because she has the title. So they both have certain rights. It's kind of a joint ownership where he has the right of using it and she has the right of the title. And if the marriage dissolves, it reverts to her unless he's Yerusher, in which case he inherits it like anything else. But yeah.
Why does the Rashba get excited about this being an exception to the Machlokes? It's just a monetary thing. They could tax all the money and take it and give it the way.
Yeah. So that's a very good question. Nobody really knows. I shouldn't say nobody knows. People have theories, but it is not clear why the Rashba had such a vehement reaction to applying the laws of Din Malchusa to the laws of Yerusha, as Dr. Edinger mentions. Din Malchusa, we do recognize the government's power in general. They can tax. So if they have an estate tax, for example, they certainly could take 40% for themselves, for the government, if they wanted to. Now, on the other hand, it is true that in general, the topic of Din Malchusa is a tremendously complicated topic, and I'm not going to have time to get into it now, but there is very wide debate among poskim as to its scope. Everyone agrees that the power of taxation is within its legitimate ambit of power. They have the right to tax. Everyone agrees they have the right to do currency, to regulate currency, to establish legal tender, and to regulate the currency. Beyond that, everything is a machlokas. Some poskim have a very narrow view of Din Malchusa and pretty much limit it to the... In the Gemara, Din Malchusa typically applies to what we would call taxation, as well as maybe something we would call eminent domain, the right to the government to seize property for the public good, to seize land or to seize your timber to build a bridge. Also a form of taxation, but similar to eminent domain, to seize property for the public good. Those are the examples, pretty much, when the Gemara gives examples of Din Malchusa, those are the standard examples. Some poskim limit it to taxation. Other poskim take a much broader view and say that anything which is in the public good, which is meant to benefit the public welfare, we follow Din Malchusa too. And there is a tremendous machlokas that goes even down to contemporary times. You'll still find poskim on both sides of this issue. Some poskim will take the expansive, broad view that Din Malchusa means that any law the government passes for the common good is binding even between two Jews. Other poskim say no, unless the government has a direct interest, like taxation or something like that, then two Jews are expected to follow Torah law and disregard the secular law. So Yerusha would be an example of something that would probably fall on that dividing line. The government has no direct interest. They can say they want to preserve good order in the kingdom, but that's not something which, according to many posts, can legitimize the Din Malchusa. I mean, it's legitimate, but we as Jews shouldn't be following it. We'll feel the broader view that anything which is Latovas B'nai Medina, then even that's valid. Any regulation of commerce or anything which is just meant to enhance order and be for the general public good is valid. And Jews follow that. Why is Yerusha an exception? That is something which is not so clear. That remains to be understood. Why? It's a good question. I don't have a complete answer. But nevertheless, it is the consensus of poskim that even those who generally take a broad view of Din Malchusa do not do so when it comes to Yerusha. A related question is, we're not going to have time to get into all the details in this, but a related question is, what is the halachic status of a will? A will that is drawn up by a lawyer under principles of secular law may not meet the halakhic criteria for a will. The issues are quite complicated. We're not going to get into them, but there are a number of issues that might preclude a legal will from being valid according to halakha. So some poskim argue that Din Malchusa would make that will valid. notably are Moshe Feinstein. He doesn't say directly, but he has a kind of clever halachic argument why in the specific case of wills, Dinin Malchusa, the main problem is the kinyan, he says. You don't have a kinyan, but kinyan can be avoided if you have Miras Das, if you have a sufficiently strong meeting of the minds, that can take the place of kinyan, and the law, he says, makes everyone be very serious about it. People take the law seriously, so that takes the place of kinyan. Sir Moshe, through his technical mechanism, does say that any legally valid will is binding lahalacha. Ramosha's position is the minority. Most poskim say that a legal will not necessarily be accepted by halacha. So it is recommended that someone interested in establishing a will that will be valid according to halacha establish the document we mentioned earlier called a shtar chatzi zachar. A shtar chatzi zachar is basically a code word. It's the name for a type of halachic will that will be valid according to halacha. They can be fairly simple, they can be more elaborate, but the common practice today, recommended by the poskim, is that you don't try to get too fancy and draw up one unified document that's valid both under legal terms, under the law, and according to halacha. That's a fairly complicated affair, and the halacha is going to kvetch about problems with the law, and the law is going to kvetch about problems with the halacha. It's going to be very hard to satisfy two masters like that. So the standard approach recommended by poskim is that a normal will or trust or whatever be drawn up by lawyers exactly as you would do it normally. Then additionally, you write a completely separate document, the Shtar Chatzi Zachar, which basically is a means of causing halacha to ratify, to endorse the will. You don't even have to restate all the terms of the will in the Shtar Chatzi Zachar. There's just a technical document by which you set things up in such a way that halacha will recognize the will. How do you do that? The basic mechanism is as follows. To short-circuit all the problems with writing a will of halacha, the person's dead, he no longer has his assets. How do you do that? Halacha has no standard provision for writing a will. What you do is, let's say a person has two daughters and two sons, and he wants them all to inherit equally. Shtar Zachar Shalom, he wants them all to get equal shares of his estate. So what you do is, let's say the estate is expected to be between $500,000 and $1 million upon death. You're hoping for the best, you're hoping you have more money by that, you hope you die many years later, you hope you get a lot more money before that. Let's say you anticipate having the upper range is about $1 million. What you do is as follows. You don't simply gift the girls $250,000 each, because that's problematic, la halacha, it's not so easy to do that. What you do is, you tell the daughters, I hereby obligate myself to you the sum of $25 million. I hereby obligate, I and my estate are hereby obligated to you a debt with a lien on my estate of $25 million, with a proviso that if my sons choose to honor my wishes as set forth in the will filed by my lawyer in the court, which declare, let's say, equal shares, then this debt is void. If they don't choose to honor the will, then this debt is enforced, and they have a lien of $25 million against the estate. So the daughters, upon death, the daughters will go to the sons and say, look, we know, most poskim say the will is not valid, we know we have no direct claim against the estate. However, we do have a bill for a lien of $25 million against the estate. Your choice. You want to pay us $25 million, which won't leave a whole lot left for you, leave nothing for you, or you can fulfill the condition that our father left in the will and honor the wishes of his will and give us the whatever was stipulated there, and then the debt is canceled. So that's usually they'll take advantage of that and take the easy way out and honor the will. So again, you don't have to specify all the conditions in the Shtar Chatzi Zachar.